Mr. Everhart, you began to write in the 1930s. How has the style and the structure of poetry changed over the last 40 years?
Well, it's changed markedly up to 1956, through the couple of decades before that. There was what was called the New Criticism, and poetry was dominated by what was called the well-made poem, and it was really an extension of the poetry of the 19th century. And poetry was then more or less controlled, you might say, by the Academy and by people like Ransom Tate, and the Kenyon Review was a model of a literary magazine of those times. But people wrote very well-made poems, and they used sonnets and villanelles and sestinas. And it seemed that the poetry of America, although it didn't know this was happening to it, got farther away from the people than perhaps it should. Then in 1956, young Ginsberg came along with his poem Howl, which changed the... It really changed. It was a historical change in the writing of poetry.
For the better?
I don't know whether I'm prepared to say for the better. I don't think I want to make absolute dogmatic categorizations. I'd just like to tell you the difference. The well-made poem ceased or went out of fashion, and the beats, so-called, began writing long, sprawling lines. I think things are inevitable, in one sense, in art. And this was a vast change in the writing of poetry. Because the young poets began to write in long, loose lines, the eschewed rhyme, and they talked about anything under the sun. Before that, there had been, quotes, poetic, unquote, subjects. But they learned that you could write about anything under the sun. As a matter of fact, William Carlos Williams, who was their poetic father in a way, and a friend of mine, taught us all from my generation down that there's no subject in the world that cannot be poetical. Then it happened that a great wave of poetry writing swept over the nation, and it's going to this day. And I think I wish I could get a count on the number of poets there are. There are literally tens of thousands of poets in our country today, from 15 years up to 90.
But there are only a handful who have nationwide recognition.
That's true, but that's probably the way it always was.
Well, the literary establishment certainly has a great deal of contempt for the popular poets, such as Rod McEwen. But what role do they have in the world of poetry?
Well, I would like to be dogmatic. It seems to me that we have two cultures in our society. If you want to put it simply, the high culture and the low culture, or let's say the intellectual approach to art and the popular approach to art. And I wish that the twain could meet, but they really haven't. And McEwen makes a lot of money, I understand, out of his poetry, and is read by millions of people. But he is not accepted by the... whom shall I say?
The literary establishment.
Yeah, the establishment people. And, well, that's a deep problem. I don't know whether one could go into it in a program like this. You have to really go into it. But I, for instance, in my own work, I suppose I'm a product of the establishment, as I went to Dartmouth and then to Cambridge University and then to Harvard. But I was a boy from southern Minnesota, and it seems strange to me that I should have gone to all those high and mighty places and that I should come to be known as an establishment poet. Then for decades I wrote in that form or in those terms. But now in my later years I wish that this dichotomy could be breached and that the serious poetry of America could reach the people or the populace. But it doesn't seem to do that.
Well, poetry takes a great amount of work, and I wonder if too many poets make it too hard for a vast number of readers to understand their work.
Well, I think that's probably true. But we have, it may seem simplistic to say it, but we always think about Shakespeare because he was unique. But isn't it wonderful and isn't it strange that in his day, Shakespeare, let's say one play, let's just take Hamlet. Hamlet could be understood by the princes who paid a few shillings to get in a fancy box. It could be understood by the groundlings and the people in between, and the groundlings stood on the unpaved floor, and they understood it too. Now, I admit that's a play, not a single poem. But it can be done, it has been done, where art has been understandable by all kinds of people, high and low, or educated and uneducated. But it doesn't happen in this country so much.
You've been teaching young poets for many, many years, including the young Robert Lowell. How do you go about teaching someone to be a poet? Is it possible to teach someone to write poetry?
Well, I think it is, or I wouldn't have done it all these years. You cannot teach genius, and you can improve talent, I think, by showing techniques and ideas of making poems. But if a poet is any good, he or she has to have some deep compulsion from which they write and has to finally get a style of his or her own. And in a sense, that the ultimate niceties of poetry cannot be taught. But you can teach people a lot along the way.
Do you have any basic advice that you give to the young poets that you deal with?
Well, I tell them to imitate their masters or the great poets of this century, for instance. There's nothing wrong with imitating when you're beginning. The whole trick would be to outgrow the necessity to imitate anybody. But I try to get my students to write sonnets and villanelles and sestinas as a matter of practice and to learn these ancient and beautiful forms. But I wouldn't want them to stay at it. I'd want them to use that as practicing scales. It's interesting to think that both Bach and Beethoven, sometime, maybe they're only 3 years old, or Mozart is said to have learned how to play when he was three, they had to learn the scales sometime. Well, it seems to me a young poet should learn the art. They should learn the great art of poetry by practice and imitation. But the last thing they should do when they become mature is to imitate anybody. They have to get over that, or they won't make a name for themselves.
Excluding yourself, of course, who are some of the modern-day poets that you admire the most?
Well, I don't want to mention names. I don't think that's very productive. I love them all. I've been around a long time. I'd have to give you 20 names, and I don't have them on my two hands at the moment.
Well, I have to say that I asked the same question of E.L. Doctorow last week about modern-day prose writers, and he felt the same way. Someone will always get hurt if you leave someone's name out.
Well, yes, and then I love them all. I really do, and I know a lot, and I've known many poets personally. For instance, I had a friendship with Wallace Stevens in the last 8 years of his life. He was much older than I was, a whole generation older, and yet he wrote me 35 letters, and I wrote him 35 back, and these letters are now in the archives at Dartmouth, and scholars come and read what he had to say. And I had friendship with William Carlos Williams, whom I adored, and I knew Robert Frost so well that he was just like an old shoe. And, you know, but if you start mentioning younger poets or from my age down or 50-year-olders, it's sort of counterproductive.
Now, most of the recognized poets today are affiliated with educational institutions, which would indicate that it must be very difficult to make a living solely as a poet.
Well, I would say it's impossible. Did you know that Robert Frost, when he was 88 years old, I think he died at 89, that's the year just at the very end of his life, when he published In the Clearing, his last book, it was said that that sold 80,000 copies and that that was the largest sale of any book of poetry by any American poet. And what good does it do him? I mean, he couldn't have lived on that anyway. He had to make it all through the decades in some other ways. And it is said that T.S. Eliot made a lot of money on his literary works, but it was as much on prose as on poetry.
Well, this goes...
And being an editor and all that.
This goes back to something you alluded to a few minutes ago, that perhaps readers are simply afraid of poetry.
I don't like to think that Americans are afraid of anything, are we? You mean the ordinary reader is afraid of serious poetry?
Perhaps.
Well, then...
If the poet cannot make a living through his poetry by selling X numbers of copies, mm-hmm. obviously the public is not buying poetry today.
Well, you know, there was a great revolution in this water, this watershed at Howell time that I told you about, the Ginsberg fatherhood of all these thousands of poets in 1956. And they were really radical, and they knew they couldn't make any money out of selling their books to the learned people. So they wrote their poetry in defiance of that inability, and they wrote for each other, and they wrote for themselves and for those in their group, and they published their poems in hundreds of little magazines, read only by the the non-successful people in America, maybe. And I think that was fine. That was a splendid thing.
I have one final question, and that goes to the Nobel Prize winner...
Czesław Miłosz.
A Polish poet who is now a United States citizen. Tell me about his work and what you know of him.
Well, I never have met him, but I have read his work for about 20 years, I guess. But he has always been off in a corner. He has kept himself aloof, and he has not been in the public eye, and he is a very modest man, I gather. And I read a splendid statement in the Times just yesterday, the day before, when he rather modestly, in one sense, wishes that he hadn't now got into this large limelight, that he wanted to write his poetry to express the truth of life as he saw it. He wanted to teach his students, as he's done. I think he teaches languages and Polish and that sort of thing out in California. And he didn't want to have to put up with fame. But now he's had fame, whatever that is, thrust upon him. And I like the modesty of his statement. His poetry is valuable to me, and I guess to those who read it, because he is an individualist, first, and because he hates oppression, second. And he had the courage to get out of his repressed country and dare to come over here where we have freedom of speech. So he wrote his poetry towards the truth of what he has to say, and he has seen a lot of suffering. He knows about the despair and the suffering. He is against Hitlerism, fascism, and all that. He's on the side of liberty and freedom of the individual. And his poetry is very direct and plain and easy to understand and very fine.
Did it come as a surprise to you?
Yes, it did. I rather admired the Swedish people for surprising us. Even the New York Times, which had a list of about six people it might go to, never mentioned the man who won. And I like that because apparently they really keep it secret, and that's good. I mean, they don't leak it to the press. That was just fine with me.
Mr. Eberhardt, I'm not going to let you get out of here without reading me an excerpt from one of your poems, and I had suggested the one on, if I can find it here, Sagacity. Sagacity?
Yes, I'd love to read it. This poem is entitled Sagacity. What is the use of being sagacious if wisdom cannot conquer time? We are sitting at tea in 2500 A.D. I said love was good 500 years ago. My times vanished quickly in a mist, but here we are enjoying tea. We are sitting at tea in 2500 A.D. Love is still our principle, quite dubious, quite good. If it were not for love, we would not be begotten, but forgotten. The world is no better and no worse. You thought of Dante as ancient. We think of you as prescient.
Thank you.